You're listening to Trobar Talks, a monthly podcast discussion of all things medieval, hosted by Trobar. We're a trio of voices and instruments dedicated to revitalizing the music and stories of medieval peoples for modern audiences.
Hello and welcome to Trobar Talks. Today we're going to be talking about an early music quartet, a book, an autobiography kind of written by Sterling Jones, who is a member of the Studio de Frühen Musik, which was a group active in the 60s and 70s doing medieval music and some Renaissance music, actually. So just a little bit of background about the group before we dive into this very detailed account of their activities. The group consisted of Thomas Binkley, who is their lute player, Andrea von Rahm, who is a mezzo-soprano, Sterling Jones, who played viol and viola da gamba, and then they had this kind of rotating tenor position, which started out with Nigel Rogers, had Roger Norrington for a very short stint, William Cobb, and then finally Richard Lovett. They were formed in 1961, and then disbanded in 1978 when Thomas Binkley moved back to the US. They got to do 33 recordings, which is insane thinking about, like, they were together for 17 years. That's about two per year. I wish we got to do that.
Were you able to track down any of those recordings online? I found like bits of their Troubadour Trouvère album and
not
Singer.
A huge amount. I listened to some of their Dowland recording because I think so they recorded on, I guess, Telefunken, EMI, Electrola, and then they had, I think it was just one album on Deutsche Grammophon. It was just that one Dowland album. And so that one is available on Spotify, so it's interesting to hear their interpretation of Dowland, because it's also, I don't know, I feel like that's one thing that's been done a million times.
There are a few things on YouTube also. You can go, there's a couple full albums are on YouTube. So.
Right.
Great. Yeah, but in general, I think a lot of these, like, they went to direct to vinyl. So I don't know if they're all in CD form or, they're not just automatically on Spotify.
It doesn't seem like anyone has been converting them to, you know, or re-releasing them.
I don't know. Yeah, it would be interesting to track all of them down.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised, though, like, if the Case Western Library has, most of their records. I'm sure Ross Duffin could answer that question.
Mm-hmm. That would be interesting. Also, maybe the radio at Case might have some old stuff. Because they have a pretty big vinyl collection. Let's see. Other things to say about them. They had, like, a pretty big impact on sort of medieval music education. Because they were the first teachers. They founded the medieval music department at the Schola Cantorum. And then Thomas Binkley went on and founded the, like, early music program at Indiana.
The Schola Cantorum is at Basel?
In Basel, yeah.
In Basel, where you are?
Where, yes. So I guess this book, by Sterling Jones, he was able to kind of construct a lot of this story again, because he has a lot of letters that he wrote to his sister and to his mom and to other people. And he kept a diary for a couple of years, which was really helpful in reconstructing some of their tours. He also has some, like, reviews and other papers that he, like, uses to kind of weave together this story, along with some random memories. But it's full of a lot of details. mostly about them and their adventures.
I have a question for you. What got you suggested this topic? What got you interested in it?
So I am currently at the Schola Cantorum and have been taking this class this past year called Musicus in Cantor with Mark Lavone. And he just, it's like a music, a medieval music introduction based on like little topics. And I don't know, I think Mark was going off on a tangent someday during class, which he makes fun of himself every time he does this, but he does it every class for like half the class. And in one of those tangents, he talked about this book, which I felt like would be a really interesting topic. It's kind of like a meta, yeah, one of the most meta topics we could imagine for like us, because it's not medieval music history, it's the history of the medieval music revival.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was such an interesting window into this world that I, you know, hear about occasionally from some of our teachers. I mean, there were plenty of names dropped in that, in the book, yeah, of people that are still very active,
yeah,
but, and that have, we've, you know, they've been our teachers or, we've been able to see them perform or something. But so I have a vague idea of how the early music revival, the medieval music revival came about. But to really drop into that world for a while, yeah, and you've, you know, because there's all this use of letters and diary entries and stuff, you really feel like you're right there with them.
Yeah, yeah.
That was fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, like, I've gotten to work with Benjamin Bagby in the past, and Allison has too, and, like, he had gone to the Schola, and he worked with them, and so it kind of, reading this book kind of helped to fill in some, like, medieval music revival history for me.
Yeah.
To understand, yeah, a little bit more about, like, I think where he was coming from. Yeah, because he was super influential for me and for us actually even starting this group.
Yeah.
Because Allison and I went to the Sequencia workshop in Vancouver, and it was all about troubadour and troubadour song. And yeah, and so much of it was about, like, getting into, like, the feeling of the music and the emotion of the music, mm-hmm, and, which I really appreciated, and I feel it's the most difficult thing to teach, and it's the thing that goes out the window first when we're trying, mm-hmm, to prepare a concert, mm-hmm, but it's the most, yeah, important thing,
or to teach it,
yeah,
to, you know, to communicate, mm-hmm, that in a music history class, mm-hmm, like that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's, and it also, as we, like, part of our process is obviously, like, trying to work directly with sources, whether it's you know, scores or treatises, or, you know, going back directly to the source, primary sources. But of course, we also are inheriting, we're standing on the shoulders of you know, our teachers, and to an, but by extension, you know, these, yeah, guys in the,
yeah,
quartet. So
definitely,
yeah, yeah. And so I think, so in this book, you get a little bit of a sense of Andrea von Rahm's personality as this, like, really big personality. and yeah, like, that the emotion of the music is something that was important. And, like, and I mean, they talk a lot about, like, how much time they, or Sterling Jones talks a lot about how much time they spent with the music in preparing these programs. Yeah. And that was something that was really, like, they really spent a lot of time. And I think he talks about, like, they had auditioned two new members for when Andrea was, like, she wanted to take some time off, and one of their tenors was leaving. And they really put these new people, like, through the every hoop to, like, mm-hmm, to try and get the sound right. And in Sterling Jones' letters back to his sister, he keeps saying how these, like, it's still not working. Oh, they're, mm-hmm, still not quite sounding right. And, like, but it'll be better, I think. But, like, even, like, months after they've started, they're, like, he's still not happy with the sound that they've,
yeah,
that he doesn't feel like they're achieving the things that that they were able to achieve with Andrea and the other tenor, because they had just been together for so long and done so many concerts and so much practicing and rehearsal.
I liked this... when he talked about the audition process. He said it was an all-day thing, and like one of the challenges is something that still comes up a little bit today, but is much more rare, which was they're giving him all these handwritten parts. So you're, like, trying to read somebody's handwriting. And then he said, like, everyone else knew their parts from memory. So they're all just, like, jamming with, you know, these pieces that they know so well. And he's trying to, like, read this handwriting and keep up.
I think it was Roger Norrington that they did that to, right? I think it was...
I think maybe several people.
okay.
Yeah.
But, like... he went on to be, like, a conductor and of, like, classical music. Like, a big deal person, but, yeah.
I think also Richard Levitt apparently complained for years that they had, like, put him through the ringer with the audition.
Okay. Maybe that's who I was thinking of. Yeah.
And so also just going off of the discussion about their slow process and the... towards the end, there are transcripts of, I think it's sort of retelling of some interviews that were done by Thomas Binkley and Andrea, and I think one of that Sterling gave as well. And one, Binkley's talking about how their process, they started out by taking like a deep dive into a particular repertoire, so they would like really try to get to know 15 to 20 pieces in a particular repertoire. And rather than trying to get a survey of everything, they say, okay, if we spend a long time with this small number of pieces, you know, I mean, if you think about like in the Troubadour Trouvère repertoire, like how many hundreds of...
Especially Trouvère songs, repertoire. Trouvère songs, so many.
Not necessarily with melodies, but... and so then in the first year... they had about 1 to 2 programs that they were able to produce. And then in the following years, they're adding on about 2 programs a year, which like that is, I think, you know, for us, we're not able to commit the same amount of time to Trobar as they were able to commit to the quartet.
Yeah.
But it's a similar process, I think. We sort of like try to bite off one small corner of things and then, you know, each year kind of gradually expand what we feel comfortable doing.
But they had some luxuries that I just feel like are not possible now. Like, first of all, they all lived close to each other and sometimes even in the same house, and so they were rehearsing daily. He said that those 15 to 20 pieces they would spend 6 months playing, which is just not practically feasible now. And they were taking like it seems like they were taking a few gigs here and there, but honestly at the beginning it seems like their main focus was just rehearsing every day, and like that's just not really possible now.
I mean, so Sterling and Thomas Binkley, they are American. They come over to Munich to like form this group with this like crazy lutenist and whoever else they can find to sing with them. And the lutenist like lends them some money to like be there, which then when things end up going sour with this lutenist, and then they get sued by him, and it's this whole like weird litigious thing. But yeah, like they end up being able to live together. It's way nicer. And even on the boat coming over, like he's like, oh yeah, we practiced every day.
But I do like that even then he talks about like, how is this gonna work? Like, there's a quote from one of his letters in 1960 and he says, "We will obviously do a fair amount of playing, but I find it difficult to imagine how it will ever pay for itself." We wonder that too sometimes.
I mean, for us, we have all these other things going on in our lives that allow us to be more flexible with the group. You know, Just to imagine just saying, okay, Trobar is our one source of income.
I know. It's, yeah. No way. No way. Yeah. But they eventually make it work because they get things that, like, we wouldn't be able to get now. So, like, they get a radio contract to play, like, once a month or something. And then they get this Goethe Institute tour, which also is this insane thing that I could never imagine, like, anybody getting now. Because they go to Pakistan.
Yeah. Like,
what?
Yeah.
Like, I think it's, like, Indonesia, Malaysia, yeah, or something. It's, like, the South Asia tour. Like, we would never be able to do something like that now.
No.
And it was this and thing
part
with
of
all,
the idea, yeah. It's sort of, I think, isn't the Goethe Institute trying to sort of promote a positive vision of German culture, yes, to the rest of the world?
Yes.
And that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they sponsored this.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they kept, oh, I loved how when they were traveling in certain areas in Southeast Asia, like, it was so humid that their, like, all of their stuff became, like, waterlogged. And so it weighed a lot more, and it cost a lot more,
yeah,
for their travel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they said the Goethe Institute was willing to cover it.
Yeah. When you say that, though, I was like, okay, yeah, I bet there's some waterlogged, but I think you guys also bought a lot of stuff, because they seem to just buy a lot of things all these places,
yeah,
that they go and
stuff,
like,
true,
and then
that's
complain
true
about how they have no money when they get back home, and they spent it all on touring.
Yeah.
Spend it all on buying things and also paying for really amazing meals.
Yeah, yeah, very, yeah, lavish, yes.
But they're also always buying things and having them shipped separately home. Like, I remember him,
yeah,
describing some rugs that he bought, and so then he had to, like, figure out how to get them shipped back to Germany, and, like, that's gotta cost an arm and a leg. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and they're shipping their car everywhere, too, because, like, so they would take the train, like, sometimes, but
yeah,
they really would try and drive everywhere, because then they would be able to save money and pack all their instruments. And, like, so they drove to Baghdad at one point from Germany. Like, and then they didn't end up having the concert in Baghdad. Like, it got canceled.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it was, like, yeah,
yeah,
totally insane. Yeah, and they played in Iran before the revolution. They played in Saigon before the Vietnam War.
Yep.
Yeah, it was just insane to me, the places that they went, and the sorts of, like, moments
they were
in history
Jerusalem
that they were able to be part of. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and, like, there was one moment in the text where Sterling Jones was like, oh yeah, there was one day in India where I was really sick and I was told that I met Indira Gandhi, and I'm like, what?
He's like, but I don't
or
remember,
like, maybe he vaguely remembers this or something, but, like, what?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah, crazy.
And he was saying that that he wasn't sure that, like, all of the music that they performed in those concerts, like, translated, but that especially the monophony was, do
yes
you guys remember,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
saying that like there they got a good response to a certain sort of monophonic,
yeah,
songs that they did, which reminds me of the whole Arabic influence controversy,
yeah,
yeah,
which comes
and it
up
was,
in this for sure,
yeah. It was interesting to me, too, that on these tours, like, they would give a concert, and then there would also be a concert of, like, the traditional music of,
yeah,
that country.
Yeah.
So they got to hear, like, some of the best,
yeah,
music of these,
yeah,
places, and, like,
yeah.
Yeah, what an opportunity.
I think they mentioned even, like, hearing Ravi Shankar, who, like, wasn't famous in the U.S. yet, but, like, was very famous in India, you know? And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you guys feel like you fully understand the whole conversation about Arabic influence? Because what I gathered was that people were accusing Binkley I wonder if it's related to the, like, use of instruments versus not, because he talks about using plectrum lute, mm-hmm. Or making more use of the plectrum lute than you know, had been done mm-hmm. as part of the early music revival, mm-hmm. and that that's as they're phasing out, you know, towards when it's late 70s, mm-hmm. they're...
Yeah.
78,
I think.
That
time, you have the emergence of groups like Christopher Page's Gothic Voices that are saying, like, you should not try to accompany monophony mm-hmm. with instruments. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's... I don't know.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit complicated, and I'm proposing that in a future podcast we have a whole conversation about this, so stay tuned. But it does come up in this, and it's funny because he, like, quotes Tom Binkley saying things like, I have very seldom recorded or played anything that is remotely Arabic. However, like, it definitely was an influence. Like, he talks about in 1964, they were in Morocco on tour, and he says, we had the opportunity to hear Andalusian Arab ensembles playing music undoubtedly similar to that of the Moors, who withdrew from Spain at the end of the 15th century. And then he later says, this strongly influenced our ensemble's later interpretation of Western medieval repertoire. And when you read Tom Binkley's stuff, like, it's not that they're playing Arabic music, but some of the principles are definitely influencing what they're doing.
Yeah, and part of that is that, I mean, he also talks a lot about improvisation.
Yeah.
And about the fact that a lot of the music that they were doing was monophonic. So what we have is just a vocal melody, maybe there's a melody, and the text. And as I was saying before, you know, with Christopher Page and Gothic Voices, for at least part of their whole career, I don't know whether Page changed his views on this at all.
I don't think he did.
So
yeah.
Nope.
He was a strong proponent for, you know, just trying to not distract from the text, I think. He really, like, I think everybody agreed that, like, the text was the main point of troubadour songs. Mm-hmm. He and if you guys jump in, like, I don't know what his arguments were for not accompanying troubadour song, but
I mean, he cites some evidence, but other people say that he's misreading the evidence. It's a whole thing.
Okay.
Yeah
and now I don't even remember where I was going with this.
Gothic Voices? You were going to talk about something.
And
improvisation.
Oh, okay.
And improvisation.
Also, it's also, yeah, so many things.
but Binkley talks about all of the music. I think at one point he uses the phrase framing.
Yeah.
All the sort of instrumental stuff to frame this vocal music. And because we don't have clear evidence about what that sounded like or what the procedures were there, you know, you have to look at other repertoires that are doing monophonic music.
Yeah.
I think you can make the case that that's a legitimate place to, you know, draw information from.
Yeah. And he's, I think he's also pointing out, like, a lot of these songs are pretty short and, like, seems like performances from the time were maybe not all that short, and there are a lot of, like, other monophonic repertoires that are very long and drawn out. Like, they talk about in India hearing, like, ragas performed, and they last, like, hours, you know, like, really extensive forms. And so he talked about, like, framing the text, but also, like, sort of building and expanding on the text. So it's still, like, a way of elevating the text, but a completely different understanding of what that practically does, you know?
Right.
Yeah, and Andrea von Rahm had a great thing about text. She talked about, in an interview that he includes, she talks about that as an instrumentalist, that working with these medieval monophonic repertoires is completely different because an instrumentalist has to be, she says, immensely engaged with the text. She says you must be interested in the poetry or else it leads to nothing. And, like, yeah, so true. That's what I
think
find
that's so true.
So fun and so, like, interesting and so collaborative to work with the singer. I love that part of it. Yeah.
So Benjamin Bagby, I did a course with him, was it 3 years ago, 2 years ago at Amherst. And Amherst always has this auction for in the middle of the week. And he had brought this book with him that he had from a course with Andrea von Rahm in the 70s that he did. And what they did was they had to write, I think it was a nonsense troubadour song. And I don't know if Tracy has talked to you about this, Elena.
Yes, she has.
Yeah, but they had put, and they like hand wrote this, their troubadour texts in here, and like it was like illuminated, and I think there's like, they each got a copy that was printed. And so this was, yeah, this auction item, but it had this whole story behind it, because it was like, he was at this course, and Barbara Thornton, and... let's see, Joel Cohen, Pilar Figueres, and like maybe some other people too, but
wow.
Like, yeah, it was like this kind of moment, and they did it at this the in Grozdan, I think, the place in Croatia where where Andrea von Rahm like had this house, and like I think she had them do these nonsense texts, and that they had to be just totally convinced of whatever it was that they had written.
Yeah.
Whatever. And it, like, and it, like, didn't so much matter that, like, the audience understood, but whatever you were doing had to be so convincing to you. I think that was the idea.
That it would communicate something.
Yeah, it would communicate. And
it didn't, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That would communicate something. Mm-hmm. And they, like, did it for the other people in the in this little town.
Yeah, they would go out into the streets and do it.
I think.
That's hilarious.
But,
yeah. Can we talk about her chart?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which we acknowledge that we have not spent enough time with.
No.
But it's this chart that she based it, at least... she was inspired by a treatise from the 15th century, did you say?
Yeah, von Zabern? 15th century.
And so this treatise goes through different types of music, types of vocal...
It's kind of like just an early vocal technique treatise. It's like our kind of the first thing that could sort of look like that. And I skimmed it recently, but I don't really remember, but there is a section where he talks about like different sort of registers of the voice, and so in this chart there's then I guess we should back up a second. So I this chart actually comes from Barbara Thornton's like master's thesis, and there's a chapter that talks about Andrea von Rahm's ideas about singing medieval music and different repertoires and how you should sing them differently with different sorts of vocal resonances for each of them.
Yeah. So she includes a diagram of resonance areas, and like one, the first one is sort of, I don't know, it's that
like your forehead resonance.
Forehead between the eyebrows. Two is your nasal cavity. Three is the nasal pharynx, which is behind the nasal cavity. Four is the tongue and lips. Five is the sort of
soft palate.
Yeah.
And then six is below, so it's the throat, basically.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All the different bits of the throat. And so then she...
And seven is, like, your chest area. So like,
seven is the chest. Got it. So she lists 15 or 16 different repertoires, including organum, conductus, troubadour, minnesang, 14th century repertoires into the 15th century and 16th century. Mm-hmm. And then the last one is early Baroque, which is, that's broad thing to make generalizations about. So then the different categories are, well, first of all, she talks about the vocal mix. And so she gives up to five different areas that you would use or that you focus on.
These, like, resonating areas. Yeah.
Resonance. Which I find highly suspect, but I haven't given it the time that exactly. it deserves. So,
for instance, for troubadour song, we have a vocal mix of 4, 5, and 6. So let's go back. 4, 5, and 6 are tongue and lips. Like,
mm-hmm. It's low. It's basically like all below the nose.
Yeah. Great.
What's one? But...
Is anything 1, 2, 3? 1, 2, 3, 4 is chanson.
The edges of the, of this. I'm pretty sure that's like French stuff.
Like French chanson. So like the repertoire that we're going to be recording in August, probably.
Yeah.
So it should be higher.
It's mm-hmm. that's yeah, it that's higher plus yeah, the tongue and the lips, front of the mouth, and then up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
What's confusing to me is the ones that mix things, like the tenor lead is 1, 3, 5, and 7. How
yeah.
I don't understand.
Well, that's very far back. It's not far forward. It's not so 2 and 4 are the front of the face. 3 and 5 are further back.
Right. But then with the forehead is number one.
with the forehead.
I don't even know. Like that just seems so difficult to make happen. But I don't know.
Hear different individuals and different national or types of singing. Obviously, like I mean. What pops into my head is like classical Indian singing. Like obviously mm-hmm. that is resonating in a very different place yeah. from bel canto right. Italian singing
right.
and
right.
belting versus
right.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. And even canto. Like languages can kind of sit in different places. So I think that's all sure. bound up in this.
Yeah. Sure.
And yeah. she has a quote in this interview she gave where she says, I have about 20 different types of voice.
Yeah.
And then she says it depends on the language requiring a different vocal production. So, for instance, whether she's singing French from the South or French from the North. And I really like she says this, for me, the diversity of the voice is more important than showing off the voice itself. But no one wants to learn this diversity. Vocal teachers say, good heavens, that damages the voice. She says, I am now 58 years old, and I still sing pretty well.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, like, on the one hand, I'm like, oh my gosh, what, like, this seems ridiculous. But on the other hand, I'm like, oh, this also seems so cool. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Definitely worth thinking about.
Yeah.
Also worth thinking about, so that she lists all these different numbers for different resonating areas, and then she has these three categories of technique, expression, and language, and subdivides technique into register, which I don't. Do you understand what that means?
I am not sure.
Is that like high versus low in a way? I'm not sure. It could meaning like sort of popular versus art or high versus low. I'm not sure.
No.
Maybe.
I would think it has more to do with. Because it's about technique. So register, support. Support's not important. Support is always important. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like...
Agility and improvisation.
Agility, yeah. I can understand that, yeah, and improvisation also.
Sure.
But, yeah, some of the, it's hard for me to understand what she means, yeah, but like you're saying about register. Because, like, okay, it should be between chest and head voice. That's what register means to me. But how does that line up with, this is a black square, this is a gray square, this is a white square? I don't understand.
So yeah, so black square means it's very important to the style. Gray square, important to the style. White square, not important to the style. And those are the most interesting, those are the most interesting squares. So
yeah, those and are fascinating.
Just, yeah, and that always seems like a little bit, that's always going to be open to question, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Improvisation could have been part of the conductus. Like, yeah.
I think that's, yeah.
And the 13th century motet, yeah.
And the 13th century motet,
yeah.
You know, and yeah. And we, you know, we know more about these genres. You know, we have access to more information about these genres than they did. They might know more than we did, but
yeah,
we have access to more information.
Well, like she says that, you know, improvisation is not important to organum, but we've just spent several episodes talking about this a few weeks ago, or a few months ago. Yeah, and that actually the more we research this, the more we realize this was probably a very improvisatory repertoire, and that what we have is just some written examples. So stuff like that we should go on and talk about expression, because I find that really fascinating too.
So expression, she divides into melody, emotion, personal expression, and diction. And emotion is the most frequently whited out square among, like, in all 12 categories.
Yeah.
And that is fascinating. There are certain repertoires that she say are highly emotional, like the troubadour, cantigas, Wolkenstein. Something romance? What does that say? Northern romance?
I'm so sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. And early Baroque. So those are highly expressive. And then the ones that are apparently not expressive, or sorry, emotional, sorry. They're not emotional. Organum is not emotional, which, again, like, remember those descriptions of organum being performed?
Yeah, and like the sirens.
Ecstatic.
Yeah, and being, like, moved to, yeah.
Which is maybe different from personal expression.
Right, which is also confusing. Like, I'm not quite sure how.
Well, yeah. Is it, you know, yeah.
That she's seeing something innately emotive in some repertoires and not in some, and then some you need to add personal expression. I'm not sure what that means either.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. There's, you know, questions of, like, whether there's an I involved. Like, the troubadour songs are first person, but is it expressing something personal, kind of? Maybe probably more than the conductus, yes?
Yeah, yeah. But they're also dealing with really
generic.
Generic genres and tropes that they are always existing
formalized
in. Yeah,
but sure. Interesting to me that she says the Latin lyric song needs a lot of personal expression, which is not something I would have thought, but I'm not sure.
Yeah 13th century motet, no expression. No emotion, no personal expression.
Yeah.
Trecento, no emotion in the Trecento. What?
Wow.
Yeah.
It would just be fascinating to talk to her about this.
Yeah, or like the English lute song, no emotion, a little bit of personal expression. That's amazing to me.
Yeah. I know. It makes me want to go listen to their Dowland.
Me too. I need to listen to it again. Yeah.
I listened to one song. It was interesting. It was my favorite performance.
Well, so she says that the Renaissance lute song, melody and diction are super important. Mm-hmm. Personal expression is somewhat important, but not emotion. To have personal expression be important, but not emotion, is so...
Yeah.
Anyway.
Confusing, mysterious. You want to talk about what's under language?
Yeah, and so language, I think, is the most blacked in. And I think this reflects just a general emphasis that I think is appropriate. I stand behind it, that this group really emphasized text. Mm-hmm. And I think...
Or at least she did. But
she she did.
Because
yeah, I know. Did you get the impression that the others?
Well, I mean, I don't know. Like Sterling Jones hardly ever in this text of this autobiography of the group or whatever, hardly ever talked about any of the specific pieces and how they affected
no.
him, or like any of the repertoires or anything. I don't
period.
Know.
Yeah. I mean, he didn't talk about them in non-text terms either.
No,
that's true.
No.
That's true.
He was more talking about just the experience of being in the group
and
traveling.
But
flying with instruments. I want to get to that at some point before we end.
Oh, can we just say really quick that like they okay, yeah, this is a diversion. We'll get back to language in a second. So and just the fact that you can see this huge span from Organum up to early Baroque, which I think they all had training in all of this, as do the three of us from our course at Case Western. That's basically what it covers. Well, we go through the late Baroque, if not early Classical, which is an insane amount of, you know, different, very, very different styles, different instrumentation for all these. And so, and they were talking about the fact that comparing their group with New York Pro Musica and also the Brussels Pro Musica, that those groups were giving concerts that were chronological and basically always going from, you know, some of the earliest repertoires all the way through to the early Baroque.
Yeah.
Pretty much. That was their standard programming procedure. And at one point, someone's talking about the fact that just... you know, because of all the traveling that they were doing, they had to cut down on the number of instruments that they were carrying around.
They were traveling with, like, gambas and viols and lutes and an organetto and some crumb horns and some, like, recorders. And
they were, like, every time they traveled, one of their instruments got damaged.
Yeah, he was talking about, because they put all their instruments, like, below with all the luggage. So he was talking about, like, how the problem was the way that they were loading the plane, and he would ask them to put his gamba case on the top for, like, I can't even imagine being able to have the opportunity to talk to the people who are actually loading the plane. And then, like, no, of course they're
doesn't
not
sound
gonna,
like it did much good.
No, it got crushed all the time. On another trip, like, an organetto, two lutes, and his viol were all damaged in the same journey. Like, it's crazy.
And if you think about ensembles today, there are certain ensembles that will do, you know, I mean, okay, like Les Delices in Cleveland, it's primarily a Baroque group, but they are starting to do a medieval program every year, and they might do early Classical and some Renaissance, but it's more typical for groups to kind of pick a period and stick with it. Mm-hmm. So for us, I don't think we're ever going to do we're never going to do a Renaissance concert.
No.
I shouldn't say never.
I mean, if you count 15th century music as a Renaissance concert, then we will. But I don't know.
This is also a tangent, but can I just say that Andrea von Rahm was saying, so if you're talking about medieval technique, and by medieval I mean before printing, and I thought that was a really interesting way of dividing things, right?
Yeah, totally.
I kind of like that.
Me too.
Well, there is this big shift in instrumentation
that
happens in the later 15th century, but most 15th century music I feel like you can do with similar instruments that work for 14th century and the 13th century. I mean, there's a, you know, these instruments are evolving from the 13th to the 15th centuries, but then you get into 16th century and you're going from, like, broken consort to consorts.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
and larger,
much more often,
more
larger
parts,
forces.
Yeah.
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 I remember when I was teaching medieval music the first time at Case, and I realized that, like, I was going to have to stop at, like, the early 15th century. And I was so sad, because I was like, what? Come on, let me teach the mid-15th century.
Yeah. So I do have to say, I mean, I don't think we're going to do a Renaissance concert, but on our English Christmas program, there were a few 16th century things snuck in there.
That's true.
Yeah. Because stylistically, they kind of fit.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And they worked for the forces that we had.
Yeah.
So.
Should we go back to, away from our tangent, back to talking about language?
So, sure. Yeah, her categorization of language. So the first one is textual meaning, the meaning of the text. Character. Okay, who figured out what Klangreiz was?
I don't know.
I have a theory, and I have no idea if this is correct at all, but it's our friend Sasha talks about the sound of the words.
Mm.
The, you know, that, like, certain languages have different, like, Occitan is very and that other languages, you know, just have different, and but that also in the troubadour repertoire, the actual, like, the sequence of vowels and the choice of dark versus light vowels and the use of sharper versus softer consonants is really, like, an important part of that repertoire.
Yeah.
I'm guessing that's what she's talking about. But I Googled Klangreiz and I couldn't.
Okay.
I couldn't find anything, so.
I believe you.
Me too.
TBD.
I'd go with that.
And then rhythm is there under language as well.
Yeah.
Which.
Which I also thought was interesting, what she thought was rhythmically important and what she thought wasn't. Like, the conductus is not rhythmically, or it's only somewhat rhythmically important. That seems interesting. But cantigas are very rhythmically important.
Hmm.
Yeah, there are just some interesting. Although, I guess she doesn't ever say that rhythm is not important. There are no.
Right.
There are no boxes.
White squares.
Yeah.
And same thing with text meaning.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's always somewhat important.
Yeah.
Yeah, but character, she says lute song, character is not important.
What?
What?
I. Okay, what does she mean by character?
I don't know. Character of the text? Character of the text. What is that?
Or, like, if there's a particular.
Yeah, to be, she like, must. In character?
I don't know.
We need Andrea von Rahm to explain this.
I know.
Or Barbara Thornton, who got it from her, but sadly
neither
can tell us.
Both fast. I know. Someone. So this thesis says that Andrea von Rahm is writing a book, which is where this is going to come from. But I haven't found this book yet. Maybe we need to do more digging. But I think she maybe never wrote it.
Yeah, I don't know of this book.
Is it like the dissertation that Thomas Bingley was going to write? And he, like, lost. He supposedly lost materials on an overseas flight, so he could never finish.
Yeah. That was hilarious.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
But he still was able to found his own program to give other people doctorates.
I know.
Yeah.
Back in the day.
Back in the day.
When credentializing wasn't so.
If you're the first one, you don't need credentials. The rest of you do.
He also seemed like quite a character. He also was always having, like, romantic entanglements.
Oh my gosh, I know. They were horrible.
The maid?
The maid. With the baby? That was crazy.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, so, okay, now I guess we have to sort of explain this story. But in this house.
I think people get it.
Yeah, okay,
I think
people great. People get it. Never mind.
There was a maid.
Yeah. Anyway.
She was pregnant. They
it
tried
was never
to
clear.
Convince Sterling to take credit for it.
To marry the girl, right?
Yeah.
No.
He's like, I mean, I think he didn't say at the time, but he was like, I'm gay. Like, this is
barking up the wrong tree.
Right.
He's like, little did they know they were barking up the wrong tree. It's like
amazing.
Yeah, or like in the beginning, before they get to the U.S., where like Tom has this affair with some married lady, and the husband like breaks his lute. Yeah. Sterling Jones is like, yeah, what a great beginning for us.
Auspicious beginnings.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I thought it might be fun just to like mention some of the names that come up. Like, there's a certain amount of sort of name dropping. Like, I thought it was really fascinating that David Fallows was like a musicological assistant for them for a while. And I think that means he was helping do like research for the programs and also maybe preparing editions. Yeah.
Yeah.
Where can we get one of those?
I know, exactly.
if anyone wants to write in
personal David Fallows.
If you would like to be our personal David Fallows, send us an email. We will accept any.
Send us your resume.
Yeah.
Then we'll get some funding from the German government, I guess, and to pay you.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But the whole thing.
Maybe we can get some funding from the Swiss government.
The whole thing, though, about. Oh my gosh. The whole thing, though, about. We should mention this part about sort of the scholarly viewpoint versus the practical, I found very interesting, because he was saying, you know, Tom Bingley had a musicological background and they were like fairly rigorous, but he was saying that the approach is really different from theirs, because when it comes down to it, as a professional performing ensemble, you have to make a choice, whereas scholars can just sort of leave things a little vague and say, well, it could be this or it could be that. But that as a performer, at the end of the day, you both have to make a choice, and you have to try to make a choice that's going to be, like, convincing, you know? It can't just... he says something about conservative musicology versus weighing, quote, the advantages of that part of the music world with those of the practicality of making it live and making it work. And I was like, yeah, that's the struggle, right? Like, academic side versus making it like a living, breathing, working repertoire.
And Andrea says at one point, we never felt opposition from other groups, rather from musicologists.
Yeah. Yeah. Sad.
Sad face.
Yikes.
Mm-hmm. Very sad. But I thought that was just an interesting thing that they were coming up against.
We have lovely musicologists on our board.
We do.
That's true.
We're trying to do musicologist outreach.
Yeah. Bridge the gap. There were some other cool names that came up. We've already mentioned that Ben Bagby and Barbara Thornton both studied with them.
Paul Odette, I think.
Paul Odette was there. Yeah, who else? I think Dana Alice Mabin Robbins was another person who was studying at Scola in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. I think they even mentioned Montserrat Figueras.
Did they mention her, or did they mention Pilar? I don't remember.
No, I'm pretty sure they mentioned Montserrat,
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
I guess Alan Curtis comes up in the very beginning, like University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. He's one of the other students there, and he like helps Sterling Jones publish this like keyboard music, Dutch keyboard music. Yeah,
right.
And then I think he like accompanies Andrea von Rahm in some early Baroque music or something later.
Yeah. Well.
Oh yeah. Sorry. One of the other crazy things that they did was that they were in a Werner Herzog film.
Oh yeah.
Oh gosh, what was it? What was the film's name? I don't even remember now. They were filming on Skellig Michael, it's featured in the end of I think Star Wars Episode 7 and part of Star Wars Episode 8. And it's like this island in Ireland, off the coast of Ireland, that's like just this giant island that like hosts puffins. It's like a breeding ground for puffins for some of the year. And it has this little monastery at the top that was a monastery in like maybe the 10th century or something. I don't remember.
Wow.
And so they were just kind of like hanging out up there for like days doing this filming.
Yeah, that was crazy. He also mentioned like that at the end of it, there were a bunch of people that were brought there and they got like flown off the island or whatever, or boated off and taken like, you know, to places to stay for the night. But a bunch of people were like left on the island to like fend for themselves overnight. Like, good luck, find some shelter. Yeah. Crazy wow. times.
Yeah.
Another person that was mentioned like early on. Oh, two more things I wanted to talk about. First of all, like that one of his earliest introductions to like medieval performance was this group called the Fiedel Trio, which I want to go find. I know nothing yeah. about them. I've never heard of them. And then he also mentions that early on they used to perform with Jantina Norman, who is like
yeah.
really fascinating singer. She used to sing with Musica Reservata. So if you look up Musica Reservata, some of their recordings, she's on there, and she has an extremely distinctive voice. So if you hear an extremely distinctive voice, it's her. Okay. She also has like an album of Dutch folk songs, which I think is on Spotify. But yeah.
Huh. Yeah, she was supposed to be their original lady singer, and then she
right.
she married some English guy and ditched.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I have a quote here from one of the reviews, and there are some pretty colorful reviews
yeah.
in there. Mostly positive. There's that one that like really tears apart their 16th century program, especially the singers. That guy hated their singers.
Yeah.
But this was one that was generally positive, but it's interesting. It's positive, but also like, I don't think the writer was trying to come off as like super condescending, but it kind of is. So he says, whatever they do with precision, authenticity, and spontaneity that communicates their own affection for the music. As for the singers, they even showed a kind of virtuosity.
Thanks.
Yeah. Miss Von Rahm and Mr. Cobb have voices of an instrumental purity. They sing on pitch and with great fluency. And where necessary, they add the dimension of characterization. Where necessary.
Wow.
The four artists were both professional and free from pedantry. And just reading the whole review, like, you get a sense that, like, this guy came in with super low expectations, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, yeah.
And was pleasantly surprised that they could sing in tune.
That they were competent.
Yeah.
But the word precision comes up a lot. Binkley uses that
yeah
word, that was one of his goals for the group, and that's, you know, probably their, you know, tireless rehearsing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, of course. Yeah. It's yeah
yeah
anyway yeah. The whole authenticity question is really interesting. There's another review saying, the Early Music Quartet is one of many organizations dedicated to the extremely important proposition that early music, even when performed in its original proportions and with the authentic instruments of the time, can come alive as a vivid experience in today's concert halls. Which, like, there, I think a lot of early experimentation was taking place on modern instruments because they, you know,
yeah.
the originals weren't available. But there was also definitely the idea that, like, well, we have more advanced instruments. Why would we want to go back
right.
to those, like, less functional instruments right. from the period?
Right.
Yeah. But also, it's interesting that it says that even when performed in its original proportions, and I don't know if that's, like, mm. just talking about how scaled down some of these ensembles.
Right, like one on a part sort of a thing? Or?
One on a part. So maybe just like two or three performers on right. any given piece, and with the authentic instruments of the time, can come alive as a vivid experience in today's concert halls.
Mm.
And I think that's an interesting element there, that like we think a lot about like do we want to try to make this music translate to the modern concert hall? Because it certainly was not intended for the modern mm-hmm. concert hall.
Right. Right.
But at the same time, I know personally I've... my response to, do you perform in Renaissance fairs? has always been like, no, because this music can stand up to the concert hall. Like, yeah. It's you know, it's interesting.
Yeah. I also, just to, like, quickly add something about the authenticity question, in one of the interviews with Tom Binkley, he calls sort of what they're talking about, what they're trying to get at. He calls it historical credibility, which I really like that phrase. Like, is this a credible choice? Is this an off, like, could it have happened? Rather than, is this authentic? Like, that's a much more problematic question. Anyway, I like the idea of credibility.
Credibility.
Yeah. It's a really neat idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think sometimes when I tell people what I do with medieval music, if they, like, once they start to think about it, they're like, but what do we even know from that period, you know? And and I always just go to, like, well, we have this text, right? We have these texts with, you know, pitches and rhythms, and to a certain extent, you know, we can work with outside sources, you know, even if it's, like, looking at other folk traditions and traditions that maybe are somewhat closer to the processes of these artists. But we also have to just, like, keep experimenting to figure out what, you know, what the music responds to.
Right. Yeah, he also had a really great quote, Tom Binkley did, about, he said something like, the real question is, what does the instrument want to play? And, like, the idea of learning from the instrument or learning from the repertoire is a really cool way of thinking about it, rather than trying to impose something on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well?
Yeah. I mean, there are many other things we can say, I think, but I don't know. Do you guys have any burning desires to say any last things?
I am satisfied.
I'm also satisfied. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you for listening to this episode of our podcast, and hope to have you listen next time. Oh, Elena has a thought.
We have to say thank you to our newest Patreon supporter, Steph Rosso, a friend of ours from Case Western. And thank you so much, Stephanie, for supporting us. And we are still working on raising money for our album. So if you would love, if you'd like to contribute to that, you can do that on the website. You can always, of course, follow us on Facebook and the Instagram account that we never update, but we'll, maybe someday we'll work on that. And
you'll
can
be
also
there
find...
when we do.
Yeah, exactly.
You'll be the first to know if you follow us. So,
and you can join our Patreon community for as little as $1 a month. It's just a nice way to feel like, you know, we have people in our court, and then you have access to all of the back episodes of the podcast, which I know you're all
dying,
have a burning desire to get to those early episodes. What were they doing a year ago?
It has been a year. I think it's like a year now, right? Wasn't our first one in
July? More than a year.
I think it's more than a year. I think we did
this
one.
Is like episode 14, I think.
Yeah.
What? How is that possible? We should have had, like, a celebratory... Whatever.
Have a drink for us.
Cheers.
Cheers. All right.
Thank you.
Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.